It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, NPR's new podcast, Life Kit, is trying something new, giving you expert advice on the questions you have, like how you can do a better job saving money or how you can talk to your kids about what's in the news. We'll hear more about the series coming up. First, when we elect lawmakers to our state assembly and senate, one big part of their job, presumably, is to write the bills that might get voted on and signed into law. But in reality, bills are often written by national corporations, interest groups, and think tanks on both the conservative and liberal sides. The practice known as model legislation means that nearly identical bills can get introduced in multiple states without the public knowing who the original authors are. A new investigation from USA Today finds that since 2010, at least 10,000 bills introduced in state legislatures have been the product of model legislation. More than 2,000 of those have become law. We'll talk to one of the reporters from that project in just a bit. First, Chris Taylor joins us. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 76th Assembly District in Madison. She's introduced legislation to require more transparency for these types of bills. Representative Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've gone out and attended meetings of the American Legislative Exchange Council. They're one of the more high-profile groups that use model legislation, mostly conservative in nature. What have you learned about their process?
Well, you know, first of all, the process is pretty darn secretive. They really don't want people to know where these policies are coming from. The people of the state of Wisconsin haven't asked for a lot of these policies. They're really policies that further a corporate agenda and really are serving to maximize corporate profits. That's really the common thread in a lot of these policies that we see.
And you've introduced legislation, I understand, that's aimed at making these kinds of bills based on model legislation more transparent. What kind of things are you hoping to change?
Well, my bill is called the ALEC Accountability Act. I want to bring more transparency and accountability to these groups that are pushing these model laws. The public never knows really who's behind them because they don't have to report like other lobbyists. They don't have to register. And so my bill really would bring needed accountability. It would require these groups that are pushing or developing or drafting these model bills that pop up, and they pop up all around the country, but they've certainly popped up here in Wisconsin, that they have to disclose who they are, what kind of money they're spending, what are they lobbying on, what are they trying to get passed. So it's really designed to increase the public's awareness and accountability of these groups.
Now, no matter the source of these bills, somebody can make the case, I guess, that, hey, if it's a good law in Arizona, why can't it be a good law in Wisconsin? Why reinvent the wheel?
Well, I don't have anything against looking at other states and looking at policies that are successful. The issue with ALEC and these kinds of groups is there's such money behind these efforts. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars spent by ALEC trying to push these proposals. So this really is a corporate-driven effort by ALEC. It's fueled by a lot of money. And unfortunately, when you have that situation, the people of the state, their voice sometimes is subordinated to all the money coming in. So the attempt is really to shed light on these practices and what's happening.
Finally, Representative Taylor, is there a balance of power issue here where you have people who are with these national groups, whatever they are, experts in how to write state law, and, you know, citizens who come in and become lawmakers? Is there a way to provide more support for people in your position to craft laws without having to look outside?
Well, certainly. I mean, legislators gather at conferences, and we have opportunities to do that during our terms. We are constantly, and I'm certainly constantly looking at other states for ideas because we want to do good policies. When an issue pops up in our state, I want to know how other states have dealt with that issue. Is there a good model that we could follow? But this is a bit different, what ALEC does. ALEC pushes a corporate agenda that might actually be contrary to the interests of people in a state. And so that's why it's so important, I think, to have more information about where some of these model policies are coming from, because these groups have a lot of money, they have a lot of power, and they do, you know, sometimes these efforts do unfortunately drive out the voice of the people. And that's why I think we see some of these policies that are really contrary to the interests of the people passing from groups like ALEC.
Representative Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Nick Penza-Statler is with us. He's an investigative reporter for USA Today and one of the authors of a new report looking into the scope of model legislation. He's also a native of Oshkosh and a former reporter for the Appleton Post-Crescent. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
Well, tell us more about what your investigation found. I mentioned that 10,000 number of bills based on model legislation. It sounds like that is a minimum.
Yeah, we know that that's probably on the low end just because we were looking for matches based on a kind of discrete number of models. So we know there are more models out there, and we know there are probably more matches. So we think that's definitely on the low end.
Who are some of the players here creating this model legislation that keeps popping up in different states?
Yeah, a lot of people know about some of the heavy hitters like Alec, but I think we were surprised, and I think readers are surprised to learn about some of these other industry groups and think tanks. You know, the group like Alice is kind of the foil to Alec on the liberal end. NCOIL is a national group about insurance. The Goldwater Institute has been really prominent based in Arizona. But then you hear these other groups that maybe you haven't heard of, the Alliance Defending Freedom, American Freedom Law Center, some of these big think tanks that crank out some of these bills that they hope to get introduced in state houses around the country.
Do you have a breakdown of conservative versus liberal versus corporate interest groups, and how many of these, at least the ones you found, how many of those each sector put out?
Yeah, so our universe of 10,000 bills that we identified as models came from a larger universe of 1 million bills that have been introduced in about the last 10 years. So, you know, of the 1 million, we identified 10,000 that are models. And then within that, about 4,300 of them were industry connected, about 4,000 were conservative leaning, and about 1,600 of those were liberal leaning. So it's more than 2-to-1 split, conservative to liberal. And I think part of that is due to, you know, funding and organization. And a lot of people have kind of thought of this issue as maybe more conservative leaning. But I think our study and our reporting has shown that a lot of it is really due to history of creating these and the organization of ALEC and the prominence of ALEC with their conventions. And maybe that's why you see more conservative efforts.
What are some of the types of legislation you've seen really become successful at spreading from one place to another as model legislation?
Yeah, I mean, we looked at some of the prominent ones. Most recently, there have been some things that you maybe see in the headlines, like Stand Your Ground, that obviously took root in Florida and then was spread by ALEC as a model all around the country. Stand Your Ground is kind of like the castle law. If someone, you know, threatens you or comes into your house, you can stand your ground and defend yourself. Other issues, even in Wisconsin, you heard of Right to Work. That's often a model put together by the National Right to Work Committee and ALEC. There's been this bathroom bill pushed by the Alliance Defending Freedom. Obviously, that drew headlines in North Carolina and eventually was repealed. Some other really prominent ones were things referred to as anti-Sharia bills, backed by that American Freedom Law Center. And that's been called the American Laws for American Courts, kind of based on this fear that there could be another religious, you know, ruling that could supersede United States law. So that's what that bill aims to prevent. And then I specifically wrote about the asbestos portion of our story, where insurance groups and asbestos producers are trying to reduce their burden as claims continue around the country for mesothelioma.
Let's key in on that asbestos one. I think the law you wrote about, people build it as the Asbestos Transparency Act. What does it actually do?
That's right. So the Transparency Act part of it refers to transparency to juries, not so much transparency to victims or people seeking, you know, a legal claim that have been injured by asbestosis. So that was part of our story, is that it sounds like it's maybe better than the victims would see it. And what it really does is it puts a few extra steps in the process. So you need to file your claim with a state trust before you can pursue a claim on a peripheral defendant that may have produced an asbestos product that had injured you. They want you to go through the trust first and then go through, you know, the civil process. So, you know, defenders of the bill say that this actually can speed up claims and it's pretty benign. Obviously, the folks who don't like this bill say that it really just adds unnecessary burdens to someone who's already facing a really tight timeline. You know, asbestos can kill people within, you know, 9 months or a year. once you're diagnosed with mesothelioma.
We're talking to Nick Penzestadler, investigative reporter for USA Today, about lawmakers introducing bills that were written by industry groups or think tanks or advocacy groups around the country. Model legislation, it's often called. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of lawmakers in Wisconsin or elsewhere introducing this model legislation written elsewhere, maybe by an interested party? Do you worry that it ignores the concerns of local voters? Or if you agree with the idea behind a bill, does it matter who wrote the legal language? Would you like to see new rules to make the process more transparent? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Nick Penzestadler, investigative reporter at USA Today. We're talking about model legislation. That's bills that are introduced in state legislatures, but they've been written by outside interest groups or corporate groups, advocacy organizations, then introduced by those state lawmakers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your comments. Do you think this is a bad idea for lawmakers to use these model bills? Would you like to see stronger rules about disclosing who originally wrote the language in these proposed laws? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Nick, given that we've got thousands of bills introduced around the state based on model language, why do you think the groups behind it often fly under the radar?
Well, I think part of it's set up to be a little under the radar. I mean, whereas an interest group could give money or back a politician that would maybe leave a trail, this doesn't leave as much of a trail. And as we found out, it's not as easy to identify them and then identify the sponsors because it is filtered. You know, you can pass it from an industry group to an organization to a conference to the legislator who eventually introduces it and gets it passed. So there is a little bit more of a separation. And I think that's why you see industry groups pursuing this route.
And do any states treat this like lobbying? Do they have, are there states that say, okay, you can do this, but you have to disclose the origins of this?
That's interesting. I mean, I think in Wisconsin, we have better access to the drafting files. So in the case that we wrote about with the campus speech bill backed by Robin Voss, it was a Goldwater model. And his staff forwarded the model to the drafting group to put it into Wisconsin statutory language, and you could track it. So anybody could file a request or call up the reference bureau and say, I'd like to see the origins of this bill. And in that case, it was very transparent. He said, I'd like this Goldwater bill as written. I'd like to introduce it. So I think that might be a model moving forward. And I think you know, Wisconsin has been pretty proactive in some cases, but in other cases that we know that there are models introduced in Wisconsin where there is no paper trail and there is no email that says, I'd like this written. There are other states that treat some of these experts as needing to register. So there are ALEC folks that travel around the country and back their own bills and testify at hearings. And that kind of pushes the boundary of, are you an advocate? Or are you a paid lobbyist, and should you register as such?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Greg is with us in Muskego. Greg, hi.
Yeah, I have a few questions here. When was the first instance of lobbyists writing legislation that was adopted in the United States? Isn't all of this just John Birch Society programs warmed over? And shouldn't all this be cited in the legislative history citations?
Greg, thanks for the call. Do we know how far back this goes, Nick? Because it's not really a formal practice. Who knows how far it goes back?
Yeah, I mean, you know, ALEC and its roots have gone back a few decades. But I think the idea of borrowing ideas from one state to the next isn't necessarily new. I think we're more interested in this phenomenon of organized efforts with some big funding and organized gathering of legislators and interest groups to put these ideas in front of them and help proliferate and spread them. That's what I think is so new. And I mean, that's a big debate I think our readers have had, is this inherently bad and is this inherently new? And I think we've seen that the prominence has maybe gone up, and there's definitely more organization behind some of the efforts.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. He also mentioned the idea of just including this in the legislative history of the bill. States, or at least in Wisconsin, I know we have these Legislative Reference Bureau documents that show some of the background. It doesn't include, I don't think, the drafting you were talking about, but that might, if that were in there, give a little more transparency, Nick?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there have already been talks kind of in the wake of our story of, should we require this in every bill, and would the public be served better by at least knowing, you know, this has passed in X number of states, it's backed by these groups, this was written by this organization, and, you know, it seeks to get this out of the bill. You know, so far, that's really been on journalists and you know, individuals to look up and discover themselves. So any other effort, I think, would be interesting.
We're talking to Nick Penza-Statler, investigative reporter for USA Today, about the use of model legislation and the groups, industry groups and advocacy groups, writing legislation that ends up being proposed in state legislatures, thousands of them, and in many cases approved by state legislatures. Nick, at the heart of this, and you all write about this in your piece, is a kind of an image thing. We think of the state lawmaker going to the capital of whatever state they're in. They find an issue of importance to their constituents. They draft some legislation. This kind of runs counter to that ground-up approach.
Right. And we, the people we talk to, you know, point that out, that there is a resource issue. And for many legislators around the country, this isn't their full-time job. I think you'll see that, especially in the Wisconsin Assembly, is these folks have regular jobs outside of work sometimes, outside of the legislature. And it is a faster way to a result. And especially if you're a legislator that has these ideological points that you're trying to make, and you have no problems, you know, borrowing ideas from either the think tank or from another state that borrowed it from a think tank. So I think it's just your perspective and you know, are you tasked with coming up with a unique idea, or is it okay to borrow what you think is a good idea from someone else?
Did you talk to any state lawmakers or others who said this is just fine? They don't really see a problem with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we saw that on both sides of the aisle, and we saw a little bit different perspective on whether they were fully aware or not. And a lot of times they were not aware, and they even insisted in some cases that it was their own language when it very clearly was not, and it was borrowed, you know, verbatim from a model. And then we talked to some other legislators who were fully aware and said, I believe in this cause, and this is the industry group that has done the technical research that I want to buy in on, and I don't have the expertise myself, my staff, so I'm going to borrow it from this group.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mike is with us in Edgerton. Mike, hello.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. What do you think of this, Mike?
I like the thing that we're looking for ideas around other states that were successful, but I think our legislators should be capable of writing their own language.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Nick, I think nobody is saying, you know, I think everybody agrees with Mike. Yeah, you can look at good ideas from other states. It's a little, they're concerned when it gets a little more, I guess, organized than that.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, we had an example of that in the asbestos realm where a lobbyist group wrote a bill about one specific company. And though they didn't refer to the company in the bill, it was a very unique set of circumstances that carved out an exemption for them. And I think that's where people start to say, this might be a little squishy and maybe over a line that we don't want to cross.
Thanks for that call. I saw you had a map showing which states had the most model legislation. Wisconsin was not, if I read it right, on the higher end. But as you were mentioning earlier, it does happen here, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there are these prominent examples where we know legislators have borrowed ideas. But you're right. Like New Jersey, Illinois, Arizona, and Oklahoma each had more than 400 examples of these models being introduced. And Mississippi led the pack with, you know, 744 models introduced in that state. And then the neighbors to the south, Illinois, passed the most models of any state based on our analysis.
Now, in your reporting, it looks like groups like ALEC and many others, part of the deal is that they write these bills, but they also build relationships with lawmakers to help spread these ideas. What kind of forms does that take?
Yeah, and I think there's been some reporting on the experience and the tenure of legislators, because when you're a new legislator and you maybe don't know the ropes and you haven't written a lot of legislation, you are much more likely to be susceptible to these efforts and to be welcomed into these conferences and relationship building opportunities to help you, you know, see what's happening on the national scale and get your legislation written, sponsored, and passed. So I think that is definitely a goal of ALEC, and we've seen that with their very successful not only campaigns to spread their models, but also in-person conferences, where we actually had a reporter attend one here in Denver last year. We didn't get to see all of the task force meetings, but it's the task force are set up as a legislator and then an industry group with voting rights to come up with the ideas that they're going to forward. And it takes both of them to get something successfully passed. And then I think pretty much is the crux of this system that's been set up. It's legislators, industry groups coming together to put their ideas to paper.
Looking forward, Nick, do you think this is something that is the tide going to turn, or are we going to see more of this kind of model legislation from national groups?
Well, I think we're going to see more sharing. And I think especially as distance and time continues, you know, digitally to decrease, it's so easy to share an idea. And especially quickly when something's taking off as a celebrity or a cause celebrity of conservative circles or liberal circles, that things spread very rapidly across the country. So in that respect, I think we'll see more of it. But I think projects like ours maybe make people think a little bit more before they introduce it without knowing the origins. So we're hoping that our effort will help both regular people understand how the system works and legislators maybe think twice before accepting a model where they don't know who wrote it.
All right. Thanks to Nick Penzestadler for joining us today, investigative reporter for USA Today. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Kirstjen Nielsen is out as Homeland Security Secretary. We'll look at what that change could mean for U.S. immigration policy. First, have you ever found yourself Googling what the best workout is? Or maybe you want to know how healthy last night's dinner really was. If so, then you've probably also spent some time trying to sort through blogs and articles that might not be the real deal. Well, now there's a podcast looking to help sort things out. NPR recently launched a series called Life Kit, a set of audio guides to give you answers to things important to your daily life. Here's a bit of what they sound like.
Welcome to Life Kit from NPR. I'm Allison Aubrey. I cover health and wellness, and this podcast is about exercise. We're going to talk about how to actually love it, or at least like it. Here's how it works. There's 3 episodes, and depending what you need, you can skip around or listen to them all. A good place to begin is...
Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez spoke with the general manager of podcasts at NPR, Neil Carruth, about Life Kit.
For someone who hasn't heard the podcast yet, give us a sense for what Life Kit is all about.
Yeah, so Life Kit is a collection of audio guides on a variety of topics, ranging from personal finance to health and wellness to parenting or imagining branching out into other areas in the future, and we can talk about that a little bit. But the whole orientation of these guides is to try to be useful to the audience. So not just to give you information or tell you stories about a particular topic, but to try and equip you with information that you can use to make changes in your life or to make improvements in your life, to make you smarter in a particular area in which you've been struggling. And we feel like audio is a really great way to do this.
Yeah, and you talked a little bit about how this is kind of a new sound for NPR. It's not what people maybe think about when they think about traditional NPR reporting. Was there any particular reason why now seemed like the right time to make this kind of podcast?
Yeah, we about a year ago, we actually surveyed our existing podcast audience about this basic idea. And we said we do an annual survey of podcast listeners. We're about to do the latest version of it. But last spring, we basically said if we were to release a series of audio guides that were on very practical topics that help, that the whole point of them was to help get you up to speed on topics of great personal interest, help you make changes and make improvements in your life. Would you be interested in that? And we were really gratified by the results of that. And we looked around at the competitive landscape, and while there's lots of competition in each one of these verticals, if you want to use that term, like personal finance or parenting or exercise, there's not really anybody who's sort of trying to do all of it, and there's not really anybody who's trying to do all of it from in the audio space in a grounded, rigorous, journalistic way. And that, you know, that it's definitely a slightly different posture toward the audience, trying to equip the audience with tools they need to make changes in their lives. But it's, I would say, continuous and consistent with what NPR is really good at, in the sense that it's based on reporting expertise and rigorous research and, you know, subject matter knowledge. You know, we're not shooting from the hip here. We're turning to our in-house subject matter experts, and they're turning to people who know even more than they do about these topics. And so that's where the guidance is coming from in these guides.
And another big part of it is engagement with listeners, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Can you talk about why that was important for the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, if this thing is successful, I think there'll be a kind of virtuous cycle between the experts and the audience. And our whole attitude is that we can learn from the experts, but we can also learn from the audience. Not just in terms of what they want to hear from us, but they're and if you listen to the guides, you can hear some of this. There are sometimes really good ideas that come from the audience. Now, we want to, you know, we want to be a little bit of a filter for those. If it seems like it might not be a sound idea, we'll check in with the experts. But where the audience has a really strong idea that seems to have some grounding and seems to be backed up by the best research, we totally want to put that out there. And we found that time and again across different parts of this project, that great ideas have come from the audience. So we put out a newsletter that comes out every time we release a new guide. We also have sort of an existing community for the personal finance content. My colleague Chris Arnold, who's hosted the personal finance guides under the Life Kit banner, and who's, you know, an outstanding, award-winning business journalist. A few years ago, when I was the business editor working directly with Chris, we worked with our social media editor at the time, a woman named Lori Todd, to create a Facebook group called Your Money and Your Life. That's a closed Facebook group, but you know, people are constantly asking to be admitted. We're constantly expanding the community, and it's a sort of largely self-regulating, ongoing conversation about personal finance. And Chris has gotten a lot of good story ideas from the people in that group, and he took the Life Kit idea to that group when we were first starting to work on it and asked them what they wanted to hear. He's gone into the group as new guides have come out and let people know, you know, what we're doing, and has gotten feedback from them on what they'd like to hear more of. So in a lot of different ways, through the newsletter, through call-outs, and through this personal finance group, we've tried to really engage deeply with the audience and understand where they're coming from.
We're talking to Neil Carruth, NPR's General Manager of Podcasts, and we're talking about a podcast that NPR recently launched called Life Kit, Tools to Help You Get It Together. And Neil, I want to talk about some of those specific areas that you guys cover. One that was an entry point for me into this podcast was your exercising series. Why was this a good topic to start with?
Well, so it's no coincidence that we launched this right at the end of 2018, as people are sort of, you know, grappling with the excesses of the end of the year and the holiday season and starting to think about changes that they might make to their habits. And so we thought that exercise was a really good place to start. I mean, we all know from our own lives that, you know, people make New Year's resolutions about getting more exercise. We know that new gym memberships spike right around the beginning of the year. We know that Google searches for, you know, exercise regimens and exercise habits, you know, also spike around that time. So we thought it was a really good time to be there. We thought it was a good time to launch this content, good way to position it, to really serve the audience with stuff that's sort of top of mind at the end of one year and the beginning of the next. So we launched with one guide on saving and investing and another guide on exercise. And I think the big message, the big takeaway from the exercise guide is that you don't have to be, a bodybuilder. You also don't have to spend a lot of money. There are little things you can do to optimize your physical activity and to get more out of it and to be a healthier person. And it doesn't mean, you know, going all the way to spending hours in the gym. It doesn't mean, you know, you need to have a gym membership at all. There are lots of things you can do in terms of walking, getting more regular physical activity, you know, building that into your day.
And Neil, in our last 30 seconds or so, any future ideas or plans for the podcast that you can share with us?
Yeah, we really want to hear from the audience about where they want us to go. We're going to continue to move forward in the three subject areas that we're already very present in, money, health, and parenting. Some other areas that we've talked about are sort of life skills. We've talked about travel. We've talked about arts and culture, so we're really excited to extend this project to include, you know, all the important areas of human experience and you know, all the areas where people feel like they need a helping hand and a trusted guide. And we hope we can provide that.
That's a great place to leave it. Neil, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rachel. Thanks for the time.
That was NPR's General Manager of Podcast, Neil Carruth, talking to Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez about the new podcast series Life Kit, a series of audio guide podcasts designed to give you expert tips on everything from how to eat healthy to using your credit cards. You can listen to those wherever you get your podcasts or online at npr.org/lifekit. Coming up, we'll talk about the resignation of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and what her exit means for the future of that department. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, an economic development expert tells us how small towns can do big things in today's economy. First, Kirstjen Nielsen has stepped down as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. President Trump confirmed her resignation in a tweet yesterday. He also announced that Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAleenan will serve as acting DHS Secretary. Nielsen made a brief statement about her departure this morning.
I share the president's goal of securing the border. I will continue to support all efforts to address the humanitarian and security crisis on the border.
The move is part of an overhaul of the department. On Friday, Trump pulled his nominee to lead Immigration and Customs Enforcement, saying he wants to go with somebody, quote, tougher. The changes come as the president has threatened to impose 25% tariffs on Mexican-made cars in response to the spike in border detentions. Ray Kozlowski is an associate professor of political science at the University of Albany. His areas of expertise include international migration, human smuggling and trafficking, homeland security, border security, and information technology. Ray, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, how surprised were you, if at all, by Nielsen's exit over the weekend?
Well, I wasn't surprised that it happened. It seems as if she was on the outs, shall we say, after General Kelly left. But and she seemed to have made a bit of a rapprochement with the White House and people in the White House, but that was tenuous. But didn't expect it to come like this and this quickly and without much notice.
Can you talk about her tenure at Homeland Security? She was criticized by Democrats for the family separation policies, criticized for the by the president apparently constantly over the last number of months. What do you see her accomplishments or her downfalls?
Well, I mean, she's was put in a difficult position, partly, again, the family separation policy. The approach was really something that was put in play by Jeff Sessions. And the problem is with these ideas is that it's one thing to enunciate these policies and then to execute them. Practically speaking, what's involved to have a type of zero tolerance policy? What kind of resources need to be put at ports of entry? What kind of resources need to be there for detention, different kinds of detention? And many of these things were not all lined up. And obviously, we saw the challenges. And then on top of that, you had the situation where DHS really did not look good, especially other agencies as well, simply because they couldn't tell people where the children were and where their parents were. So it was a matter of, you know, information systems not being able to talk to each other, and really made things look really bad in terms of the organization itself.
And before we return to the leadership of Homeland Security and related agencies, I want to get your thoughts, since you study this kind of thing, on the current situation at the U.S. border with many people, often families, coming up from Central America. Big picture, what are you making of this current situation?
Well, one of the things we have to understand is that the United States has historically had individuals coming primarily from Mexico, overwhelmingly from Mexico, young men who were coming to work in the United States. And when we see those apprehension figures from 2000 of 1.6 million, I mean, this is what we're primarily talking about. But over the past 5 years or so, what we have seen is this increasing number of unaccompanied minors and then families. And what's happening is that these people are coming for asylum. They are asylum seekers. They're not the people who, well, quite frankly, the Border Patrol was set up to try to apprehend and intercept. And that is those single men. And they had gotten used to it and gotten very good at that. But they're not equipped, if you will, to deal with families who are applying for asylum and in these numbers. What we are experiencing is, in a sense, what Europe has long been experiencing with asylum seekers coming.
And what kind of policy approach would be appropriate then?
Well, according to our law, these asylum seekers should be given a credible fear hearing when they enter into a port of entry, when they come into a port of entry, whether that's if they fly in and apply for say asylum, I'm here for asylum, whether they turn themselves in within the United States as well, within the country at some point, and they say, I seek asylum. And then there's a process of adjudicating that application. And so one would think that we should be able to do this, right? But the problem is that we do not have the resources allocated toward, again, hiring enough asylum officers for the USCIS and having them ready, and then having a sufficient number of immigration judges to adjudicate applications and appeals to applications.
Talking to Ray Kozlowski from the University of Albany, political scientist there, looking at the departure of President Trump's Homeland Security chief and other shakeups in that agency. Ray, there's reporting pointing toward President Trump's advisor, Stephen Miller, known as a hardliner on immigration, one of the few people there with the president in the White House since the beginning. Do you have thoughts on his role in immigration issues?
Well, he's been, again, he was a staffer for Senator Sessions, and he was helping Senator Sessions resist comprehensive immigration reform in 2013. He's been, again, a hardliner on the issue, you know, since that time. And apparently the interpretation now of the shakeup here is that Miller is going to be calling the shots from the White House. And, you know, it's all very interesting, but it's another thing to actually get to turn a large ship of a bureaucracy like the Department of Homeland Security and to actually implement policies, because you have to have very clear direction and consistent direction and guidance to the people on the ground. And that's been one of the real challenges. And as you know, if things change rapidly and the people, the officers don't know what they're supposed to do next, it doesn't make them particularly effective.
And we have at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as we mentioned, President Trump said his choice, Ron Vitello, to head up the agency. He's out before taking over. He's looking, the president, for someone tougher. What could tougher mean in the context of immigrations and custom enforcement?
You know, I'd like to know. I don't know what exactly that's supposed to mean. Basically, the Trump administration, you know, coming in has reversed the guidance that the Obama administration gave. Now, the Obama administration said that ICE should focus on criminal aliens, and particularly those who have violent crimes, et cetera, and put the resources that way. And there were those in ICE who thought that they were being, in a sense, constrained. Chains were on. They weren't necessarily able to deport as many unauthorized migrants as they would like. Well, the gloves came off, as it were, and they were allowed to pick up anybody. They were picking up people who were coming into court to report or into the office to report. And so, you know, in terms of numbers, they're able to deport more in the way of numbers. I don't know what tougher really means. The one area where ICE does also have authority, and that's enforcing employer sanctions. And you know, here we saw a raid at in Texas, and it's the largest raid at a workplace. 300 unauthorized migrants picked up, but I didn't see very much about owners or managers being arrested. And that's one of the things that you don't see in ICE statistics, is how many employers were fined in the last 2 years. So maybe, who knows, maybe they'll get tougher on employer sanctions. But quite frankly, I doubt it.
President Trump has talked about cutting funding that's going to the three Central American countries that are the source of these migrations, not direct aid, and for the most part, to those governments, but often to nonprofit NGO groups. What do you think of that change?
Well, as I understand it, again, this is not the first go-around with flows from Central America. Back in 2014, there was another asylum crisis. And by the way, again, President Obama had asked for a lot of resources that the House Republicans resisted giving. But the one thing that did come about was the provision of resources to assist with law enforcement and also with some of these NGOs to come up with alternative ways of dealing with conflicts, et cetera. And one of the things that happened is that the murder rates in some of these, the worst towns in Honduras, et cetera, had declined. So, you know, if that had something to do with it. And we're pulling this kind of these resources out and also the assistance for law enforcement there. We just may have higher murder rates and even more reason for people to flee those countries.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Ray Kozlowski from the University of Albany talking about changes at Homeland Security. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we talked about food failures. Our guests and I shared some of the times when our cooking just went wrong. And you shared some of yours, too, on the show, including the caulk in the oven before the turkey was made. Not a good Thanksgiving scene. We've got a few more now that you shared over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked you if something had ever gone wrong and what you learned from it. We heard from Brandy. Brandy says, yes, I learned that broil on the oven does not cook things faster. It turns them to dust. That's, yeah, I think probably a lot of people have had that one. I've been pretty good with the broiler. I'm really nervous about it, so I stay right there and watch what's going on. That's a lesson I haven't had to learn the hard way, but Brandy, I'm sure you're not alone. Ezra says, I blew up an angel food cake in the oven on the second date with my current wife. So despite the cake blowing up, it all worked out. Ezra says, I learned I probably shouldn't be trying to bake cakes. I don't know. Try that again someday. Give the angel food cake another shot. And Kim writes, yes, I learned that making candy is a scientific endeavor. All ingredients should be measured with precision, and the candy thermometer should be watched closely. Kim doesn't describe the negative outcomes. I assume it was just something very uncandy-like. But Kim, those are all the reasons that I personally have never tried to make candy. You can keep sharing your cooking failures over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.